Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I thought today I would take the time, without a guest, to tell you a little bit about my experience with the Whole 30 diet. The Whole 30 diet is something that has gone viral. It is on the internet. A lot of people are trying it. I am now into approximately 40 or so days on the Whole 30 diet. Excuse me. And I want to share my impressions with you. I've written a couple of articles on this so far at drhoffman.com. So some of the material that I'm talking about in this podcast, you can get an elaboration of with references and links if you go to the news feed at drhoffman.com. So what is the Whole 30 diet? The Whole 30 diet is a paleo diet that was developed by Melissa and Dallas Hartwig. What they tried to do is they tried to create sort of a coherent system by which people can sample the benefits or lack thereof of 30 days on a paleo diet. Now, since there's a sort of general consensus, but not 100% agreement on what precisely constitutes a paleo diet, they have come up with their version of the paleo diet. So they also, in the books on this subject, and you can read It Starts With Food, also The Whole 30, The 30-Day Guide to Total Health and Food Freedom. But what's very nice about them is they're very generous. They have a lot of web resources. There's a lot of community. They've got Facebook and Twitter. And you can learn a lot without even laying out a dime except for the food expenditure, which you have to make a commitment to. And they will make available sources of foods, but you don't have to buy the foods from them. I think that all in all, it's a very altruistic enterprise by Melissa and Dallas Hartwig. Before I get into the precise parameters of this of their diet, why did I do this? Why did I undertake this? Well, I was already on a pretty good diet, on a diet that is completely dairy-free, also gluten-free. However, I was consuming a fair amount of gluten-free breads, pastas, things sometimes like gluten-free bagels. I put leftover salmon on gluten-free bagels. And so I was consuming a fair amount of starch and carbohydrate calories from that. I was on in principle, a no-sugar diet, but I was having a fair amount of dark chocolate, which is it's a source of sugar. So I was consuming that. And frankly, I pretty much went every day with having a little bit of chocolate, kind of looked forward to it. Maybe I was a little bit addicted to sugar. In addition, from time to time, I would have a cocktail or a drink, maybe a couple of fingers of vodka, a little shot of whiskey, less wine and beer because I'm sort of allergic to them, and maybe going out to dinner, I would have a little bit of that. So I wasn't alcohol-free. And I was also using things like conventional canola mayonnaise, which is prohibited on the Whole 30 diet, and we'll get into it. We'll tell you a little bit about that. And I was consuming an enormous amount of peanut butter. Peanut butter is a legume, which is prohibited on the Whole 30 diet. So that was out. And I was also having beans in the form of lentil soup. I would sometimes put beans in salad dishes. I would have chili with meat, with beans in it. And so beans were included in my diet. I was having Mexican food that consists of beans. And I was having a fair amount of corn as well, which is prohibited on that. I was having corn tortillas for my Mexican food. I was having popcorn on occasion, natural popcorn preferably. But so while my diet was very clean, with a lot of organic natural food, not a lot of sugar and junk, there were certain things that I was having that are prohibited on the Whole30 diet. Now, so why did I try it? Well, I wasn't afflicted with any particular serious health problem. I felt pretty good. But from time to time, you know, it's sort of those energy lags, a little bit blown away maybe by what we call postprandial fatigue. You know, after you eat, you feel like knocked out. I found myself, you know, craving and maybe putting on the feed bag a little bit too much, eating a lot of food, although it didn't affect my weight very much. My weight's pretty steady, and I really didn't do this in an effort to lose weight. And part of the reason is maybe I'm genetically not prone to weight gain, although my dad was, you know, a little bit overweight. My mom's usually maintained pretty good weight. So that wasn't the goal. I think part of it's also that I'm pretty athletic, burn off a lot of calories. So it wasn't an effort to lose weight, reverse diabetes, or had a horrible autoimmune condition, terrible brain fog, chronic fatigue syndrome, any of the possible rationales for undertaking the diet. Nonetheless, I said, hey, you know something? This could be kind of an adventure. And I am a nutritionist. And January is a time for dietary rectitude. And so I did it as kind of an exploration in the name of science. On Christmas Day, I took the 30-day challenge and started out with the Whole Foods diet. So, you know, there are other diets out there that are similar. There's Dr. William Davis's wheat belly diet, where he doesn't just eliminate wheat. He tells you to take off, get off grains. There's Dr. Terry Wall's Wall's diet, which is a paleo diet that's designed specifically for people with MS, but she, you know, has popularized it for a wide variety of conditions and is getting the word out. There's, of course, the original Dr. Lauren Cordain's paleo diet. And what these diets have in common is they purge modern foods from the menu. There's no cereal grains because it's thought to be a modern innovation. No processed foods, no sugar. Depending on the diet, no legumes. And that is one of the distinctions of the Whole30 diet. I'll get back to this later. No legumes. There's no dairy because, after all, you know, primitive humans took breast milk, but after that they didn't drink cow milk. That was the result of later domestication. There's no refined oils. And so many of these diets purge nightshade vegetables like potatoes, eggplant, green peppers, which, interestingly, the Whole30 does not. Okay, so that may be a source of some trouble for some people because they may be sensitive to nightshades. So what is the diet consisting of? No sugar whatsoever. So sugar in all its forms completely out. No weasel words like agave syrup or sugar alcohol. You know, like in the Atkins bars, no fructose, no maltitol, no organic honey, no dark chocolate, no juice extract. You know, some of these things are sweetened with grape juice. Well, that's just, you know, kind of like another way to put sugar into a product. You got to just go cold turkey. There's no alcohol, and there's no dairy. There's no grains whatsoever, so you can't even have quinoa or unusual grain, brown rice. No, that's a grain. And there's no legumes. They also prohibit trans fats, and they minimize polyunsaturated fats, except for omega-3 oils, which you get from fish and flax oil. But they actually emphasize saturated fats from meats, ghee, which is butter from which the protein has been removed, lard, and I actually have collected lard from bacon that I make. I use nitrite-free natural bacon, and I collect the lard, and I use it sometimes to make my eggs in, saute things. You could also use a lot of coconut oil, which is rich in saturated fat. And the preferred nuts are nuts high in saturated fat, like macadamias. So instead of some nuts that tend to be fairly high in omega-6, they want you to have a little less of those nuts. Those might be nuts like sesame seeds and things like that. So they're actually wanting to do sort of an oil change towards more saturated fat and omega-3 fat rather than polyunsaturated omega-6 fat. They do allow nightshades, and they do allow... This is not a diet to put you into ketosis. This is not a no-carb or an ultra-low-carb diet, although you can fashion it to your requirements. Say you want to lose a lot of weight, so you'll cut more carbs. But this diet does include potatoes and squash. I've began to enjoy butternut squash. You put butternut squash into the oven at 400 degrees for an hour and slice it open, and it's really delicious. And you can put a little cinnamon on it, put a little bit of ghee on it, and it tastes really good. And you can have potatoes. Now, that violates the nightshade prohibition that is in some of the paleo diets. But the Hartwigs, you know, it's a little arbitrary where they draw the line. They say that if you've got a problem with nightshades, avoid the nightshades. They emphasize animal protein, but they don't tell you just to eat, you know, some popular conception of the paleo diet is the caveman diet. You're going to be eating like brontosaurus steaks, you know, like in the Flintstones or something like that. No, they don't want you to have huge amounts of meat, because they really tell you to have quite a lot of fresh vegetables and fruits in the diet. And I've actually noticed that, you know, when I cut back on starches, I'm having a whole lot more vegetables, a lot more variety. You know, having a putting a bagel in the toaster. By the way, when I started the diet, I put the toaster away. The toaster is gone because I'm not toasting any you know, gluten-free bagels or gluten-free muffins. No more of that. So when you don't have that, you end up eating more healthy vegetables, more variety. I can't remember the last time I put a Hubbard squash in the oven and bothered to cook it and eat it. But that's, you know, if you want some carbohydrate source, that's going to be the carbohydrate source. So looking at this diet, you know, and I'll tell you a little later how I responded to the diet. You know, some of the criticisms that may be leveled at the diet, I actually take up in one of my posts at drhoffman.com. It's like, so what's the big deal with sugar? I mean, is, and also they're, you know, they're really about zero tolerance of sugar. Is sugar really worth banning completely? And can't we just tolerate maybe a little bit of sugar here and there? I mean, life is short, sweets are enjoyable, and as long as you exercise adequately, you can burn off the sugar. And I agree. I think that for people who are really healthy and in balance and they're not bothered by it, a little sugar may not be a problem. But so often, sugar is a problem because it's just an extra source of empty calories. It also contributes to inflammation, contributes to a roller coaster of blood sugar that can result in hypoglycemia and mood effects and brain fog, brain lock when your blood sugar is low. And it then ultimately leads to insulin resistance with resultant obesity, inflammation, and even heightened risk for cancer. So it is really worthwhile exploring your relationship to sugar on a diet like this. And that's what it forces you to do. It forces you to confront it because you can't have any sugar. And it is excruciatingly hard for people to give up sugar. They may say, well, I don't have that much. Well, once you take stock of it and you really pay attention and you get off, well, you may go through a period of serious withdrawal for a few days where you're just dying for your sugar fix. But eventually, you will recalibrate. And I found something very interesting on the diet is that I really now have a much heightened sensitivity for the sweetness of foods. And it's kind of cool because I'll have a salad with balsamic vinegar and fresh tomatoes and beets. And I can really taste the sweetness of those things that hitherto they weren't sweet enough to reach my sweet detection threshold. I had to have you know, dark chocolate to feel the sweet hit on my taste buds. So and that's to the good because it's more, the foods are more satisfying. You don't need to go to supercharged sweet desserts. You can enjoy the sweetness of berries now. They taste like an ice cream sundae because your taste buds actually adjust to that. So, and it's a rare individual doesn't have, to a greater or lesser extent, a sugar addiction that's going to propel them towards ever higher carbohydrate consumption. It's just in our DNA that we opportunistically seek out sources of sugar, because in primitive circumstances, that was always a way, that was a hedge against starvation. So a powerful drive to seek out carbohydrates. And unfortunately, in the modern world, they're unlimited in terms of our access to them, whereas in our primitive natural state, they were an occasional treat. You know, you might stumble across a beehive and endure bee stings to harvest the honey, or you got lucky and came across berry bush in season and collected the berries. That's a berry that, if in the wild, a berry season is very evanescent. It's a very short period. And, you know, for 11 and a half months out of the year, you might not have that. So, this is important. And, you know, the exercise thing can offset sugar. That's what they say when they tell you, oh, drink, occasional Coke or Pepsi. Exercise will offset it. But, man, you got to do a lot of exercise to offset the effects of that. And I've seen athletes who are elite athletes who take too much sugar and they're overweight while they perform very high levels of training. So, and then you get older, you get an injury, and you're eating the same way, and then the pounds come on. So sugar, really, it's, I think, valuable that Whole30 prohibits it. Okay, what about alcohol? Well, you know, I'm not a teetotaler, and I'm not on some kind of moral crusade to ban alcohol. And unlike some people in the natural world, the natural health movement, I don't think that alcohol is an unmitigated evil. I think that alcohol can be enjoyed socially, responsibly. If you've got a drinking problem, it's not for you. But is part of a social ritual. It's relaxing. Many studies show the benefits of alcohol, that people may have less heart disease, whereas the increased risk of certain other conditions like stroke with more alcohol, certainly liver disease. But it's really interesting to see what happens to your focus and energy when you get off of alcohol. So it's worth exploring that. And I have to say that I had not had, I think the last sustained period that I was off alcohol was when I broke my hip. I couldn't really drink because I was taking pain medication for a while. So those things don't mix well. But it's really interesting because I think you sleep deeper because alcohol, you know, people take a night cap to sleep better. But ultimately, they're kidding themselves because they sleep, you know, they fall asleep more easily, but they may sleep more lightly. They may have middle of the night wake up. It's a less natural form of sleep. My sleep is awesome off alcohol and with this diet. And I think I have more focus and energy, and my productivity is greater. So, you know, the times where I used to kind of come home and relax, kick back, you know, have a drink, I just relax in other ways. You know, I just don't need the alcohol. And it's reassuring to know that it's there, it's optional, but it doesn't have the better of me. I can control it at will. And, you know, I'm not sure for the rest of my life I'm not going to have a drink because I have all this expensive booze gifts sitting around my house and my apartment that I'm sure I'm going to access, future occasions. But for now, I'm giving it a rest. Okay, what about dairy? Well, dairy is a problem for a lot of people, for some people not. And there's actually a branch of the paleo community. They're sort of paleo. That believes that unpasteurized dairy is okay. It's the pasteurization that makes it a problem. On the other hand, the Hartwigs in the poll 30 say stay away from dairy. Part of the reason so many people are allergic to dairy, also is very addictive, particularly cheeses. It's got casomorphins, which mimic the effects of opium in the brain, literally getting you hooked. And also with other effects such as mood effects, and many patients have urinary problems, migraines on dairy. And so getting off dairy could produce some interesting results for some people. The argument that it's not part of a natural human diet can be challenged from the standpoint that the genes for digesting milk are rather ancient. They may have developed as, 20,000 years ago or more. through a mutation, and you know, up to a certain point, humans could not drink cow milk, but then they began to adapt to drink cow milk. It became a calorie source and a nutrition source, and that's to the good of, you know, marginal societies that don't have a lot to eat. They had yet another source of calories to provide them with the ability to grow and survive. So is it that most of us are not designed to digest milk? Well, some of our forebears many tens of thousands of years ago may have acquired that gene, and it doesn't necessarily mean that none of us should have milk. There's also some concern about dairy, particularly the galactose impact on certain cancers, possibly ovarian, possibly prostate. And then dairy also, because it's an industrial agricultural product, contains a lot of hormone and pesticide residues. It's high in the food chain, may contain or concentrate environmental pollutants. And so getting rid of dairy might be beneficial for some. When it comes to grains, again, there is evidence that even tens of thousands of years ago, even before domestication, what are called proto-humans, you know, the Neanderthals or their Cro-Magnon compatriots, gathered grasses and pounded their seeds into primitive loaves, maybe with the addition of fire and heat, and augmented their calories, with dietary sources of carbohydrates. So, you know, and there are also many studies that suggest that having whole grains is beneficial. So for the average person who's eating junk food, adding whole grains, substituting whole grains for junk food would be beneficial because the fiber is beneficial and there's more nutrients in whole grains than there are in refined grains. But, you know, many of my patients really benefit from grain elimination, those who have carbohydrate cravings, who are overweight. Also, many patients with gastrointestinal ailments follow what's called the specific carbohydrate diet, or the SCD. And that is a diet that involves no grains. And it's very healing for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Also, the autism community has embraced this, and many kids who have brain problems are benefiting from that approach. So what about legumes? Well, that may be the most controversial aspect of the Whole30, because in calling for the elimination of legumes, the Hartwigs might be on shaky scientific ground, because they claim that you just get a lot of superfluous caloric starch from beans, but beans are also offering their carbohydrates in a low glycemic index package, which time releases slowly. It's encased in a high-fiber matrix, and that might be beneficial for the vast majority of people. They invoke the controversial notion of what are called lectins, which are plant substances that normally protect plants from pests and may have a damaging effect on the gut wall, which can promote leaky gut when you eat beans. And that's a controversial notion. It's a notion that actually got promoted initially by Loren Cordain, who's the sort of the father of the paleo diet. And it's not clear that all people have adverse reactions to beans, but peanuts certainly can be very addictive and allergic for some people. So taking peanuts off the table and peanut butter off the table may be beneficial for helping some people lose weight. Soy, also problematic because most of it's GMO, and there's some concerns about the hormonal effects of soy and the goitrogenic effects of soy, anti-thyroid compounds. So, you know, they make the argument in the book. You can read the argument. I think that argument is going to receive some pushback from many mainstream nutritionists that legumes can be part of a healthy diet. I'm not sure that I'm going to eliminate legumes forever, but it was a worthwhile experiment. Bad oils. They also prohibit, the Whole30 prohibits trans fats and it minimizes polyunsaturated fats. So, to its credit, the Whole30 got me to rethink the gobs of conventional Hellman's mayonnaise that I used to use that contains poor quality GMO soy and canola oil. So instead, I now use special mayo made with avocado oil, which is healthier. I'm not putting bad oils into my system. And that's, I think, a worthwhile element to the diet. So at this point, I'm going to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And then I'm going to share with you some of my impressions of the diet, and also share the impression of one of our, actually, one of the people who's behind the Intelligent Medicine podcast, who has had a very beneficial response to the Whole 30. So stay with us. Part two will continue on the subject of my review of the Whole 30 diet. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.